are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Coke's story is based on the brutal murder of a housewife in the Denver suburbs in 1973. A college student back then, Stephanie Kane was more than a witness to this terrible crime. For nearly 30 years, she remained silent. Then in 2001, she tried to exorcise the crime by fictionalizing it in a mystery novel called Quiet Time. But instead of laying the murder to rest, Quiet Time brought it roaring back to life. Cold Case Story is about a family that fractured along the fault lines of a murder. It's about fiction colliding with a cold, hard crime, and the very personal story of how it feels to ping-pong between participant and observer, novelist and witness to one's own uneasy set of facts. In the end, all are punished, even the guilty. The book that we're featuring this evening is Cold Case Story, with my special guest, journalist and author, Stephanie Kane. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Stephanie Kane.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Thank you so much for joining us. Let's get right to this exciting story, and very detailed and complex as well, I might add, and your participation in this incredible story. Let's get right to June 1973. June 8th, I believe, and tell us who you were living with. Tell us the living arrangements. You had a fiance named Doug, and this is in Boulder, Colorado. His mother called, but give us the background on your situation at that time and Betty and Dwayne Fry's situation at that time. Give us the information that was given to them about your pregnancy. Give us your status in terms of where your marriage was in terms of planning. Give us that background before we get into June 1973, June 8th.
So I had just come to the University of Colorado in Boulder. I grew up in New York, Brooklyn. I basically came to Colorado because it was 2,000 miles away from my folks. It was the only place I applied. I knew nothing about it. And, of course, you know, I fell in love with a guy I met in a karate class who was as different from me as anything I could imagine. And we started dating in our freshman year. And he brought me home to meet his parents, and they were very, very different from my family. I'm Jewish, so, you know, we were ethnically as different as can be, which was part of the attraction, I think. His family was Catholic. His mother was very, something sort of out of the pages of, you know, Better Homes and Gardens. She was very beautifully put together, blonde, etc. His father, Dwayne, was an engineer who worked at Martin Marietta, very buttoned down and domineering. And, you know, so I was, you know, the girlfriend, and Doug brought me home. We had dinner with his parents. On the way back to Boulder, we were living together in a little apartment off the hill in Boulder, which is like a student district. And his parents knew that we were living together. And, you know, we'd drive home and I'd be crying, oh, they'll never accept me, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, to cut it short, cut to the chase, in June 1973, we were engaged to be married. And I had gotten pregnant earlier that year and had had an abortion. And it was right after, like literally within a week or two after Roe versus Wade was decided. So it was a legal abortion. And, you know, nevertheless, it was a wrenching decision, but it had the effect of pulling us closer together and making us more committed to having a life together. So we got engaged, and we were set to be married that June. We informed his parents, and, you know, they were certainly not thrilled because there were cultural and ethnic differences. And then Doug decided to tell them about the abortion. And I, you know, he didn't run it by me first or anything, because that would certainly have made it impossible for them ever to accept me. So, you know, it was not something I thought they needed to know or should know. And that was right before Mother's Day that May. And so things between us were very, very tense leading up to the murder. On the day of the murder, it was a Saturday morning, the first or second Saturday in June. So just a gorgeous, beautiful, hot day. And Doug was teaching classes at the karate studio where we met. I was taking some summer courses so I could graduate earlier from college. We were both college students. And that morning, after Doug had left to go to the karate studio, Betty called. And it was completely out of the blue as far as I was concerned, because, you know, she had never called our number before, and she did not like acknowledging that we were living together. And, you know, it was really just a hot point. And she wanted to know, you know, if we could get in touch with one of his older sisters who was also living in Boulder and apparently didn't have a phone. And so it was a very short, stilted conversation. I think actually Doug was in the shower when she called. But anyway, I was the one who spoke to her. And, you know, his take on it was, well, maybe she's finally coming around to the wedding. Because at that point, we didn't even know if she would be attending the wedding. Anyway, so a couple of hours later, I went to meet Doug at the karate studio, and his father, Dwayne, was there, which was another total shock because we had no idea he was coming. It's about an hour drive from where his parents lived to Boulder. So it wasn't like just a, you know, a casual kind of thing where you just drop by. He had a bruise on his forehead, and he was wearing dark clothing, a long sleeve shirt and a t-shirt underneath. And it just, you know, I mean, it was shocking to kind of see him there because they weren't really acknowledging that we were living together and things were tense between us. And he had this big old bruise on his forehead, and he was just such an immaculate person that, you know, it just really jumped out at me. Also, I had just walked down the hill and I was sweating and I was wearing shorts and a t-shirt, and here he was in these dark clothes. And, you know, I asked him about his bruise, and he said that he had been doing some house cleaning with Betty that morning, and a lawn chair or something had fallen on his head from a shelf or something. And, you know, the whole thing was just very bizarre. Then it was also bizarre because his ostensible reason for being in Boulder was to pick up Doug's 13-year-old brother, who had taken the bus from where his parents lived to Boulder that morning to take a karate class from his big brother, Doug. And as far as we knew, we were going to put him on a bus to go back. So Dwayne showing up to pick Greg up made no sense. And then, you know, what happened next made even less sense, which is he said he wanted to see our apartment and to show it to Greg, which was like completely bizarre because Betty did not want, she had made us promise that Greg would never even know that we were living together. So, you know, here it was, you know, and it just seemed like it was, you know, and plus Betty had not mentioned anything about Dwayne coming up to Boulder. So for all these reasons, you know, it was a very, very strange situation. So he drove us back to our apartment with Greg. They looked at our, you know, basically one-room apartment. And then after about 15 minutes, Dwayne just kind of jumped up. He stood up abruptly and said, "We gotta go, we gotta go." And, you know, when he left, he had said something about trying to find a place for our wedding dinner or something like that, which was another bizarre thing because, as I said, we were even not sure whether they would be coming to the wedding. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing was just completely bizarre. And then the next thing we knew, later that afternoon, we got a phone call, I think from a neighbor, saying, you know, "You need to come home. There's been a terrible accident." And the accident, of course, was that Betty was murdered. So we drove to the house, and there we were. That was that day. So I was one of the last people to speak to Betty, and one of the first to see her killer, you know?
You include that the last time that you did see Betty personally was at a restaurant. Tell us about that event and what was strange, if anything.
Well, the significance of that event is this was after Mother's Day. This is between Mother's Day and the murder. Mm-hmm. So Betty or Dwayne called, I guess I'm sure it was Dwayne, called us up and said that they wanted to take us to dinner. And, you know, again, we thought, oh, gosh, you know, maybe they're accepting the marriage. We had dinner at this place called the Flagstaff House, which is, I think, still in Boulder. It's, you know, a place where parents visiting their kids, you know, take them for a fancy dinner, you know, in the college town. And Betty cried, and that is when she made us prompt. I mean, Dwayne ordered these little glasses of creme de menthe to toast us, but Betty cried, and on the driving us back to our apartment, which she refused. You know, they didn't want to get out of the car and see. She made us promise that Greg would never know. This is Doug's little 13-year-old brother, would never know that we had lived together before we got married. So when Dwayne showed up, you know, a couple of weeks later, you know, after killing his wife, and he wanted to show Greg where we were living, it was like completely, you know, crazy. I mean, I felt like we were violating a promise to Betty. I didn't know she was dead, but, you know, if she had been alive, that would never have happened. In retrospect.
Now, you found out about Betty's murder or Betty's death, and now how do police proceed? What do you find out, and what do the police find out?
Well, bear in mind that I'm answering your question on the basis of what I learned after the cold case. Mm-hmm. Because at the time of the murder, we were told virtually nothing. Dwayne, you know, led us into the house. He sat his children. Doug had two older sisters who were, you know, living in Boulder, so we drove to the house with them. And he sat us all down at the dining room table and said that Betty had been killed by a burglar. She had surprised a burglar, you know, and the police were all over the house. There was fingerprint dust everywhere. We were not allowed to go into the garage where her body was. Her body was still there when we arrived because there was an ambulance in the driveway. And, you know, police never interviewed me. I think they spoke to Doug briefly. And, you know, we spent the night there, which is certainly something we never could have, you know, in Doug's bedroom, old, you know, high school bedroom, which certainly would never in a billion years have happened if Betty was alive. So, you know, that was very strange. Mm-hmm. And so what we knew then was the kids lined up completely, unquestioningly behind Dwayne. And
right.
It was sort of taboo to talk about it. And part of the first reason it was because there was a grand jury. And Doug was a witness, and I think his sisters were, or at least one of his sisters was as well. And so, you know, the thing was, you can't talk to anybody about anything because, you know, Doug met with Dwayne's lawyer, but he couldn't tell me what they talked about, and, you know. So we were very much in the dark. And then when Dwayne was indicted for first-degree murder in 1973, we were all of the kids and me were brought to the courthouse for his bail hearing, because they wanted to put a big show of, you know, family support. But the minute they started talking about what had happened to Betty, you know, the children were made to leave the courtroom. I mean, it was part of the show that the lawyers put on. So, you know, we just, no talk about it. Then, you know, he was, his trial was scheduled for right before Thanksgiving of that year, you know, within the 6-month speedy trial period. And just before the trial, he called and said that the charges had been dropped, that there was some witness who had seen a suspicious pickup truck on the street in front of the Fry House that day or something like that, and some carpenter who had seen something from a roof, and that's all that we knew. And it was never discussed again, at least not in my presence. And I don't think in Doug's either. So everybody just kind of went on with their lives. And Dwayne married a very close family friend who I also knew because she was part of the, you know, sort of the family circle, who divorced her husband abruptly. And then they moved away. They moved to California, then they moved to Florida, and, you know, his sisters scattered, and the family basically just, you know, it just not disintegrated, but everybody just left, and there was never any discussion. So, you know, I had this feeling because Betty had been told about the abortion and was strongly opposed to marriage, that somehow our impending wedding had been a trigger or a factor in what had happened. And, you know, but I just, you know, we all just went on with our lives because talking about it was taboo. And there was nobody to talk to about it anyway, you know.
When did this all change for you? And tell us about the origins of Quiet Time.
Well, what happened is I basically, our marriage lasted about 10 years, and we got divorced, and I was just no longer a part of their family. And I was left with all of these feelings that somehow my coming into that family had upset some kind of fragile balance or something. Okay. And I didn't talk to anybody about it. I became a lawyer. I went to law school, got a job at a fancy firm, didn't tell anybody anything about my past, you know. And then in the early 1990s, I met my second husband, coincidentally happens to be a judge. And I told him, he's a federal judge, not a state judge, so he had nothing to do with, you know, any of the prosecution of Dwayne or anything like that. And, you know, his question quite naturally was, well, didn't you ever find out why the charges were dropped? You know, don't you want to know? And I thought, well, yeah, I guess so. So he had gone to law school with the guy who had been the DA back in 1973. And the DA, you know, we arranged to meet with him, and we met for, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes, very brief meeting. The DA said he couldn't remember much about the case. He blamed dropping the case on, you know, the lead detective who he said had come from the state patrol, and we don't investigate cases like that anymore. In other words, that the guy was some old-timer who didn't know what he was doing. And he gave me just a little, you know, a few, maybe a dozen sheets of microfiche fragments of police reports that were almost illegible. And then I went to the courthouse And I asked if I could, you know, get a copy of the 1973 case file. And they for me, and I got, you know, one of the defense lawyers had attached a transcript, a grand jury transcript, of the lead investigator's testimony in the 1973 grand jury. And that gave me, for the first time, a sense of, you know, the physical evidence and the forensics, you know, at the crime scene. And, you know, so I thought, it was, all of a sudden I had some sense of what had happened physically on the day of the murder, you know, and what evidence the police had to work with. And then I did some more research. I got whatever news articles I could find, and then I started to write it down, you know, just first of all, just my memories of that day. And then I knew nothing about writing a novel, or, you know, I'd never written a book or anything like that. And I started imagining to try to come to some closure myself. Now that I had at least the facts of what the police had seen that day, I then tried to imagine what other people in the family might have felt or seen or experienced. And I wrote them out in their imaginary first-person voices. And this was all for purpose of me getting some kind of closure on what had happened.
Right.
And then I wrote draft after draft, and I started to, you know, I would show it to people, and they'd say, this would make a great mystery. And, you know, I started to teach myself the craft of writing a mystery. And with each draft, it got more and more fictionalized, because it had basically, the first draft had served my purpose of, you know, sort of just getting it all out.
Right.
And now the characters became imaginary. You know, I fictionalized them. I drew up a plot, you know. And, I mean, the problem with Betty's murder was that it had no ending. So, you know, I just ran with it, and, you know. And I wrote an imaginary, fictionalized version of it. And then after about 20 drafts, I got an agent, and she submitted it to Bantam. And I was very, very frank with Bantam about the origins of the story. And Bantam made me make other changes so that the characters would be unrecognizable. They made me change Denver and Boulder to Wyndham and Stanley, or Widholm and Stanley. You know, it was to make it all so that nobody could ever imagine that it had anything to do with a real crime. And I also adopted my second husband's last name as my pen name, because, you know, I didn't want anything to come of it. To me, it was now just a completely fictional mystery. And so it got published, and it actually came out like a week or two before 9/11. And so, you know, it died. The book died, had a very short life, and died a really fast death. It bombed, you know, which was fine with me, you know. And then about 4 years later, I had been interviewed by a public TV station on books. And, you know, it was just a short little interview, and, you know, it was about my fictional book, Quiet Time. And the station, as it turned out, lost its funding, or the program lost its funding. So the station would play, I came to learn later, reruns of this interview with me, like in the middle of the night. In 2005, Dwayne, my former father-in-law's sister, who was at that time like 78 years old or something, was watching late-night TV, and she saw me be interviewed, and she recognized me. And even though the story was a fictional story, she recognized elements of it.
Wow.
So she went out and bought Quiet Time, and she read it, and in some sort of crisis of conscience, she came forward with information about a confession that Dwayne had made to their mother, and that their mother had told her before she died. And so a cold case was opened. And, you know, kind of the horrifying thing for me about the confession, which, again, I didn't know anything about, I could never have imagined, was that Duane said that he lost his temper, began beating Betty, and the trigger for that was the abortion and our wedding. So in a horrific way, you know, my worst fears were actually realized. It had been a trigger. And so but I didn't know any of this until, you know, sometime in 2005, I got an email from a cold case cop. And he said, you know, were you Betty Frye's daughter-in-law, and did you have an abortion in 1973? And, you know, and do you mind talking to us? So, you know, I felt, you know, I certainly had nothing to hide or anything that I was ashamed of. And so I called the cop, and then we met for about 6 hours. And then, you know, they had a grand jury. I certainly wasn't the only witness. And, you know, it just went from there. It was reopened as a cold case. And Duane, I think he was about 80 at the time, was reindicted for his wife's murder. And, you know, the whole thing started up anew. He had very, very aggressive lawyers. He'd done quite well for himself. He spared no expense. So it became a sort of a war of attrition. You know, in cold cases, the defense lawyer's playbook is to basically run the clock, you know, mm-hmm. in the hopes that witnesses will die and that the case will be transferred to another judge and, you know, the DA will be rotated off the case and, you know, just basically delay, delay, delay. And that's indeed what happened. I mean, the cold case hearings went on after the grand jury period. Hearings went on for at least a year and a half. And, you know, and then it got mired in, you know, the appellate courts because of the admissibility of the confession. And indeed, witnesses died. Indeed, the original judge was rotated off the case. Indeed, the original DA had to leave because she had to try a death penalty case involving gang members who had executed a witness. You know, so the strategy worked. And, you know, then when the cold case was officially over, it took literally, I think, about 6 years through the appellate courts. And by then, almost everybody, including the sister who had come forward with a confession, had died. And then, except Duane was still alive. And then I got, so I, once it was officially over, as a witness, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't, you know, I didn't look at, you know, any material that I had. I didn't look at quiet time. I didn't look at, I couldn't talk to witnesses. My hands were tied. I was basically muted and paralyzed for that long period of time. And then once it was officially over, I made a request for the case files, an official request, an Open Records Act request, and I got the entire, except, you know, they kept back some things that were confidential, like medical records and stuff like that, but very few right. things. And I got the whole file from 1973 and 2005. And from that, I was able to piece together, you know, the final things that I didn't know. And then in 2013, I got an email from a woman who had known Duane and his second wife, you know, the woman he married after Betty died. And she just wrote to me out of the blue and said, did you know that Duane Frye is dead? And I said, no, I had no idea. And neither did the cold case cops. So I called this woman. We had a long conversation. And she filled me in on what Duane and his second wife's life had been like. And Duane basically converted his second wife, who had been a very, a nice, you know, woman, but very, very dumpy. Not anything like Betty's sort of image of femininity and beauty and all of that. He basically reshaped her into Betty. She had been, you know, overweight and frumpy and thick glasses and, you know, kind of mousy brown hair. And according to this woman who had known them the last 20 years, she, Barbara, back in life, he had converted her into a slim, stylish, blonde version of Betty. And he had controlled every aspect of her life. She was allowed to see only a very small group of women that were living in Florida, whom he approved of. You know, he controlled all of her interactions, and that was the price she paid. So anyway, in 2013, Barbara started to have dementia, and he put her in a nursing home. And almost to the day, 40 years after he had bludgeoned his wife, Betty, to death in their garage in Denver, he blew his own brains out in his house in Florida. And that's what this woman was emailing me to tell me. So I contacted the cold case cops. They got the name of the cop who had responded to the scene of the suicide. And I called them. And I explained to him, you know, I was not encyclopedic about my relationship with the family, but I was honest with him. And I guess I caught him at a moment, you know, where, you know, he was open to speaking. And he told me about the scene, and I said, did he leave a suicide note? And the cop said yes. And I said, and he said, but it made no reference to Betty's death, you know, or his earlier life.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop. Sorry. Let's use it as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. You talked about he committed suicide. He left a suicide note, but he did not mention Betty at all. So any opportunity for him to shed some light on that deathbed confession didn't happen. We've told the audience and jumped ahead to the very end where this case is resolved. It was dismissed. The cold case brought it back. Three times they would have had to indict Dwayne Fry for this murder, and they didn't. And there was a decision at the end. Instead to try to indict him again, they would go to the appellate courts because of the, right, as you mentioned, the admissibility of that confession, which was crucial, because he had made a confession to his mother, Lolita, and then he had also made, or Lolita had also told Sherry, his sister Sherry, about the confession. So there was an argument about the admissibility of that. So, as you say, they basically ran out the clock. Everybody, many, many witnesses were gone, and so this case was finally dismissed. What we didn't talk about is the evidence from this, the lead detective, this Sendel guy, that was dismissed by wasn't aided very much by the prosecutor whatsoever, and was taken apart by Leonard Davies, the defense attorney. But there was a lot of valuable information that you gained when you talked to him finally in 2013. Or tell us about that when you finally got to speak to this lead detective,
well,
Sendel.
The first thing that, before I go into that, I just want to say one other thing, and that is that when the case was finally over, I sat down with the DA, and she told me that Dwayne's lawyers in the Cole case had offered to plead him guilty,
mm-hmm,
if he served no jail time.
Right.
So there's no doubt that he killed his wife, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Sendel is a really interesting character because, as I said, when the DA first described him, I pictured this old rube, you know, somebody who just, as my husband might say, couldn't find his butt if it had moose antlers on it. But when I got that, I cleaned it up a little there. When I got the 1973 grand jury transcript when I went to the courthouse back in the early 90s, and I read Sendell's testimony. He was totally sharp. He didn't miss a thing. And one of the things, one of the big pieces of evidence, which is why I don't think that the confession was, you know, a make or break for the case, because there was such strong physical evidence against him. And here's what I mean. Betty was killed, you know, sometime between like 10:30 and noon on the Saturday morning of June 8th, 1973. And the killer had staged it to look like a burglary gone wrong. So the house had been ransacked, and Betty's body was found bludgeoned in the garage, sprawled next to some trash barrels, where the supposed burglar had been gathering loot. Now, I found out that this is an all-too-common scenario in domestic murders where the husband kills the wife. I mean, it's not uncommon at all to stage it like a burglary. But Duane made two mistakes that morning. And the first was that when he ran around the house gathering the loot to stage it, you know, ransacking it and gathering loot to make it look like a burglary, he pulled three clocks out of the wall. He was gathering up to put in the garage to make it look like the burglars were carting away stuff they stole from the house. And what he did was he unplugged three clocks. This was back in the early 70s when there were clock radios. Right. And, you know, when the alarm goes off, the radio starts playing. Anyway, there were three clocks that had been plugged into walls, and two of them were in bedrooms upstairs, and one, I think, was in the kitchen. And, of course, when he unplugged them, the clocks stopped. So you had this sort of GoPro-like video track of the killer's progress through the house.
Right.
I think one clock was like 11:22 or 11:23, then there was 11:24 and 11:27. So you knew that the burglar had been, you knew exactly what room the burglar had been in at what moment. And Duane just wasn't counting on that. So that was the first mistake he made. The second mistake he made was, in the middle of all of this, Greg, the 13-year-old son who was in Boulder that morning taking a karate class from Doug, he had a little 13-year-old friend who lived a block or two away. And that morning, this other little boy named Brett was watching the monkeys. And the monkeys were over at 11:30. So at 11:30, Brett walked over to the Fry house and rang the doorbell to see if Greg would, you know, wanted to goof around with him. And so it's 11:35. And Duane Fry answered the door, like right when he was in the middle of ransacking the house while his wife's body wasn't even cold. He just instinctively answered the door. And that placed him there. And you know, the cops, one thing that the Sendell did was he checked the TV guide, you know, to confirm the time it must have been. And, you know, so they had Duane right at the scene, leaving the house, you know, right while he was answering the door. The other interesting little piece of evidence back then was there was some carpenters working on a house that was catter-corner to the Fry house, and one carpenter in particular was on a scaffold, and he had kind of a bird's-eye view into the Fry backyard. And right at that, in that same time frame, he saw a guy exit the back of the Fry house, walk through the backyard, and fiddle with the back gate. The way he initially described the guy, it fit Duane Fry's description. And the fact that he was fiddling with the gate was significant because when the police arrived at the crime scene, that gate, which was like a 6-foot-tall wood slat gate facing the street, you know, fencing off the front yard from the back, that gate was ajar. And it had never been ajar because, in fact, it had historically been wired shut from the inside, from the backyard side, with a wire coat hanger. So whoever fiddled with the gate removed the coat hanger and opened the gate to make it look like that had been the point of entry. When if it was a legitimate burglar, it never could have been because it was wired shut from the inside. So that was more evidence of the crime scene being staged. And then when my hands were untied after the cold case was officially over, and you know I got this just mountain of material, including crime scene photos and audio tapes of and transcripts of interviews of the Fry children in 2005, and you know just this massive amount of material. I thought, you know, I wonder if this guy Sendel is still alive. Because in my mind, I was still picturing him as some old guy, you know?
Yeah.
And I looked him up on the web and found that he had, was a retired police chief up in Minnesota. And I called him because I had questions for him. And, you know, a day later, I left a message. And a day later, he called me back from Arizona, where he and his wife spend the winters. And I said, you know, would you be willing to talk to me about your memories of that day? And it turns out he had been a grand jury witness in 2005. And according to the cold case cops, he had the jury eating out of his hand. And the guy was nothing like what I had imagined. He was nothing like what that DA had described him as. He was totally sharp. He had a great memory. He was in his 70s. He was very vigorous. And he'd never forgotten the case. And so I went and I visited him down in Arizona at a trailer park where he and his wife spend their summers at mobile home park. And I had brought crime scene photos and he was able to explain to me, you know, things that I hadn't understood, like why the crime scene photographer had taken a particular shot, you know, what he was trying to capture. And you know, there are lots of shots of the gate with the, you know, the wire hanger removed. And he just, you know, he was wonderful. He explained to me very briefly back in 1973, the 13-year-old boy, Greg, my little brother-in-law, had been a suspect, really briefly. And, you know, Sendel had vivid memories of how each of the witnesses had struck him at the crime scene, you know, his impressions of them. Mm-hmm. And it was just priceless. And it really angered me that that DA had thrown him under the bus in 1973, blamed him for the case being dropped, when nothing could have been further from the truth. And then in the early 90s had you know scapegoated him again, you know. So that became actually one of my little tiny little motivations in writing Cold Case Story, because I wanted to set the record straight. And Sendel was somebody who had really been wronged, you know.
You talk about how he was wronged, but it was the prosecution didn't do him any justice and let the defense tear him apart as well. Can you explain what exactly happened in that regard?
Well, there was another interesting character that surfaced back in 1973, and he was a defense investigator who Duane's lawyers had hired.
Right.
And this guy, his name was Jim Blake, he was a retired New York City police lieutenant who had relocated to Colorado because his wife was ill or something like that. And so, you know, he was doing some private eye work as kind of a sideline in his retirement. And he took over the case. And one thing he did was, after the crime scene had been released by the cops, by Sendel and his guys, this guy Blake purports to find fingerprints that the cops had overlooked. And he said he found them, I think, in a drawer, in a dresser upstairs, which had been ransacked. And so he says, look, I found these fingerprints. And he goes to, I think, a buddy, but I'm not sure, who was on the police squad. And he says, you know, I found these fingerprints. And the cop says to the DA that he went to, an assistant DA maybe, says to Blake, well, gosh, you know, what a coincidence. You know, we just nabbed two would-be burglars, kids, really, teenagers, basically, who had been caught, like, right in that same time frame, within days of the murder, I think, attempting to burglarize a burger joint that was a mile or two from the Fry House. And so they were in jail, and the cops had taken their fingerprints. So this defense investigator, Blake, says, well, I'll tell you what, you know, give me their fingerprint cards, and I'll compare them to the prints that I found, and, you know, we'll see if it's a match. And, of course, the quid pro quo was that Blake would give the cops his set of prints, and they could make, you know, their own comparison. But that never happened, print cards. And he says, gosh, they're a match. And so, you know, the cops and the DA, not Sendel, but, you know, the DA says, oh, my goodness. You know, and they dropped the charges against Dwayne Fry using the fingerprints as their main reason for doing so. And the two would-be burglars were never charged. One of them was polygraphed about Betty's murder. He completely passed the polygraph. He had nothing to do with it. He was never in trouble with the law again. You know, he went totally straight. The other guy became sort of a career, you know, low-level burglar and alcoholic. But he was never, these guys were never charged, even with the attempted burglary that they were arrested for. And, you know, the DA just used it as an excuse to dump the case. And a month or two after the case was dumped, you know, it's in the file, this is how I know this, there's this letter from the assistant DA to Blake or the defense lawyers saying, by the way, could you show us those fingerprints you found? You know, we kind of like to make our own comparison, but the fingerprints were never found.
Incredible.
That's because they never existed. And, you know, that's how the case got dumped in 73. And then in 2005, you know, all of a sudden the defense resurrected Blake as, you know, one of their arguments for why the cold case should be dismissed was that Blake, who by then had been dead for, I don't know, 10 or 20 years, that because he was no longer alive, Dwayne Fry could not have a fair trial because Blake had been, you know, the white knight, you know, that was indispensable to the defense, and his death meant that Dwayne could not properly mount a defense. You know, it was so cynical. It just, you know, it makes me angry just talking about it now. And I think that this is not, the thing about this case is, I think that this stuff like this happens all the time. And the only difference between Betty's case and other cases is that, you know, there isn't somebody who looks more deeply into it after the fact and tries to piece together what happened because they have some personal involvement in it, and, you know, that they want to, you know, come to terms with. So I think this happens more often than we want to believe. And it happens today.
You write about one of the heroes of this story, if there can be such a person, but at least somebody willing to risk certain things and lose certain things because of telling the truth. And that would be Dwayne's daughter, or pardon me, sister, Sherry.
Sister.
Pardon
sister,
me, yes.
The one who came forward with a confession, Sherry.
Mm-hmm.
She was a wonderful person. Just a very, I mean, I knew her way back, you know, in 73 when I was part of that family. And she was sort of the black sheep. She was kind of artistic and creative. And she didn't have any of the prejudices that the rest of Dwayne's family or Betty's family had. She was just kind of a little bohemian, you know, if you can use the word, for somebody growing up in Depression-era Kansas, you know. And she was just very much her own person. She was pint-sized. She had sort of a longshoreman's voice. And she just, you know, everybody told her not to come forward with the confession. One or two of her children were lawyers, and they said, oh, you know, the confession, it's going to get thrown out of court. It's hearsay, and you're risking it. But she just did what she thought was right, and it cost her her relationship with her entire family. Not her children, but with the extended Fry family in Kansas, and certainly with Betty's children, who even in 2005 lined up behind their father. Which is another curious thing to me. You know, I've always wondered why, because you see these stories all the time. A father kills a mother, usually, and the kids line up behind the father. And I just always wondered what that was about. And, you know, I don't have a good answer for that. I'm not a psychologist or, you know, somebody who studies families. But that's a very troubling thing. And it's, for Cold Case Story, you know, just to jump ahead to the, you know, something that happened that wasn't part of the crime but was part of my coming to terms with it, I interviewed a guy named Howard Morton, who founded this cold case families advocacy group called Families and of Victims of Homicides and Missing Persons. And Howard had founded this organization in Colorado because his oldest son, Guy, had been murdered in Arizona in 1986, and that case had never been solved. But anyway, it made Howard, in his retirement, and his wife start this organization, which continues still, even though he's no longer part of it. But, you know, I had questions about cold case families and Howard's experience. So, I turned to the Internet. I didn't even know if he was still alive. He was no longer with that organization, but I found him through LinkedIn, which I joined for the express purpose of trying to reach Howard Morton. And, you know, I emailed him, and he got back to me right away. And then we had a very, very, you know, hours and hours long conversation. And I asked Howard, you know, did you, in your working with cold case families, did you ever come across families that didn't want to know the truth, you know, that resisted having a cold case opened? And he said yes, and they were always families where it was an inside job, and the survivors, the children, didn't want to know, because in all likelihood, knowing would mean, you know, that they would have to admit that their parent had killed their other parent. He told me some other really... Oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry, you talk about not knowing why a sibling or, you know, a child could look the other way or not want to know the truth. And you were married to his son, Doug. What we didn't talk about, and there's so many of these events and these anecdotes, where his father gets to talk to him after his mother is dead. And so he thinks there's an opportunity to share some, reminisce some stories about his mother, because he's craving that. He has a hunger for that. But what actually does happen? What does Duane actually say to his son about his mother?
Well, this personally, just speaking as Stephanie, the thing that I hold the most against Duane Fry is not, I'm ashamed to admit this, it's not that he killed his wife. It's that I believe he basically killed his son. And what I mean by this is that shortly after, I guess it was right before, it was after Duane was arrested, we put off our marriage, or wedding, for a month or so we got married in July. And she was murdered in early June. And after she was murdered, but before we were married, Duane called us up and said, I guess I should have been, you know, leery anytime Duane called us up and said, hey, would you like, I'd like to come to Boulder and take you to dinner. But anyway, that's what he did. And he said that he wanted to share some memories about Betty with Doug. And, you know, there'd been such silence and, you know, towing the line and not being able to talk and craving, as you put it, some way to come to terms with his mother's brutal death, and for especially because he must have felt, I mean, I know I did, but it's nothing that we really discussed, but I always felt that he must have felt some responsibility also, because he had told her about the abortion, and that was completely right. Unnecessary. And, mm-hmm. You know, I think that that's what had tipped the fragile balance over. But anyway, so Dwayne calls us up and he says that he'd like to take us to dinner, you know, and talk about Betty. And so we went to this place west of Boulder called the Red Lion Inn, this beautiful rustic restaurant. And he immediately, you know, we're expecting all these warm, you know, loving memories of Betty so that Doug would have that to hang on to. And instead, Dwayne gave this litany of his grievances against Betty. I knew that Betty had had some kind of mental illness because Doug had been aware of it, but not the details. But apparently she had manic depression, and she had been hospitalized for periods while Doug was growing up, which he and his siblings were unaware of because there was such shame around it that Dwayne would, you know, nobody would talk about it. And, you know, she'd had shock treatments, and at the time of her murder, she was on lithium, which back then was a pretty experimental drug, and, you know, it was hard to gauge the dosage and stuff like that. But Dwayne just launched into this litany of, you know, how her illness had prevented him from, you know, becoming more successful, and, you know, if he could have invested in this, if only he hadn't had to take care of her. And then he said that if it was up to him, the two youngest children, Doug and 13-year-old Greg, would never have been conceived, would never have been born, that she essentially tricked him into having them. And, you know, Doug was just... It gutted him. I mean, it just, and, you know, luckily after the charges were dropped, Dwayne, you know, moved to California and then Florida. And, you know, we saw him, he came back to Denver for a period of time and we saw him and his new wife and, you know, but for the most part, he was out of our lives. And then in 1980, Doug got into medical school, I got into law school, and Doug had a mental breakdown in, I think it was his second or third year of medical school, and, you know, we attributed it to stress because he was commuting. We lived in Boulder where I was going to law school, and he was going to medical school in Denver, so he had a long drive every day, but he basically... I don't know why we didn't talk about it, but we would take, you know, every Christmas we had a vacation that overlapped because he was on quarters and I was on semesters, and we would go and visit my parents for, you know, a few days in New York. You know, we saw him once a year, and this year, one of Doug's older sisters was living in New Jersey because the family had just scattered after Betty's death. So he had one sister in California and one in New Jersey. And Doug said to me, you know, I think I'd like to go and see Lynn, his sister in New Jersey, while we're in New York, because I want to talk to her about our mother. And, you know, so he took, when we were in New York, Doug took the bus to Cherry Hill, New Jersey, or wherever Lynn was living. And he came back and he was like, he was, you know, not catatonic, but just, you know, gutted, and I said, well, what did Lynn say? And he said, Lynn told me that she always knew that Dad killed Mom, and that she was surprised that I even had a question about it. So, you know, we go back to Colorado. I start law school again. He starts medical school. And he had a mental breakdown. He made a suicide attempt. And he was in a hospital on a hold, and he had to take a semester off, and he was under the care of a psychiatrist. And he would come with me to my law school classes, and he couldn't let me out of his sight. I also had a job working in a court, you know, after school, and he was with me all the time. And then one day he said, you know, I'm feeling better now. I think I don't need to come to school with you today. So he stayed home, and I got home. And when I got home, the house was empty. There was a note on the table. And he said, you know, I've gone to Florida to talk to my father. You know, he wanted to talk to Dwayne for the first time about the reality of Betty's murder and Dwayne's involvement in it. And he got, you know, then the phone rang, and it was Dwayne calling me saying, well, I got this message from Doug, you know, he says he's coming down here. Do I have to be here? And I said, well, you know, he's coming down because he wants to talk to you, you know. And anyway, then there was everybody, you know, there was like radio silence for 2 or 3 days. I couldn't reach anyone. Nobody called me. And then finally, my mother in New York called me and said, you know, do you know that Doug is in a mental hospital up in Pennsylvania? And, you know, he had apparently called my mother, who he was close to. And, you know, she said, is it okay if I talk to his doctors? And I said, yeah. And she said, and can I give them your phone number? I said, of course. That night, I had a long conversation with his psychiatrist in Pennsylvania, and they said, you know, Doug is basically not communicating at all. You know, he's like a zombie. And, you know, his father deposited him here, you know, just flew him up there from Florida, I think because it was near Lynn. And we don't know anything about his background. We didn't even realize he was married. We'd been married almost 10 years by then. We didn't even realize he was married until your mother contacted us. And can you fill us in on you know, what's wrong with Doug? And I said, well, what did Dwayne tell you? And Dwayne said that Doug had some bizarre fantasy that Dwayne had some involvement in Betty, Doug's mother's death, you know, 10 years earlier. And I said, well, it's hardly a fantasy. He was indicted for first-degree murder by a grand jury. And they were like flabbergasted. So I, you know, when I look back on Dwayne, what makes me so angry is what he did to his son. And he did it just to save his own skin, you know. He just threw him under the bus, time after time, to justify or rationalize. And you know, the day of the murder, he came to Boulder not because he wanted to see us, but because you know we were an alibi for the murder. You know, time after time, he used. I mean, I don't know what his relationship was with his other children the way I know what it was with Doug, but you know, it was just, I hold that against him. You know, I just can't find any way to, you know, to justify that or rationalize it, or you know, I think that is the man. You know,
you talk about, you write about, pardon me, that you look for the motive, and others look for the motive for this. You talk about a life insurance policy that would end up being, in today's money, $850,000. But we didn't talk about was this humiliating scene where a friend of Betty's, Barbara, is laughing and joking and having a great time with her husband. And then the crying jag that started at night and was still going on the next morning. You talk about that this announcement from Doug that the abortion, that you had an abortion, that he was involved with that as well, that this strict Catholic that had mental issues would be so upset. But tell us about this event and this seemingly obvious motivation for murder.
Well, I have to be, I've always looked at Barbara, Doug, or Dwayne's second wife, kindly, because she was nice to me, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
She was nice to me in 1973. And when Doug left me, she sent me a Christmas card saying, I'm so sorry how it turned out. That was the only thing I ever heard from the Fry. You know, once Doug and I had split up, you know, there was like, you know, they were glad to see me gone, I guess. But so I've always looked on her somewhat kindly. And the incident you're referring to happened the night before Betty's murder. It was a Friday night. And I learned of this only when I got the case file. But I also had it confirmed from Betty's closest sister, a woman named Jean, who also, you know, still gave me lots of hours of interviews on the family and growing up and, you know, all of the forces in Betty's life and stuff like that, and her marriage to Dwayne before I was ever a part of the family. And this is what happened. Apparently, the night before the murder, Dwayne and Betty were having dinner at a popular Mexican restaurant in Denver, which no longer exists. And there was a third person in that party, and this was the family friend, Barbara, whom Dwayne married shortly after the case was dropped. And apparently, you know, he and Barb were sitting there having drinks and laughing, you know, just yucking it up. And Betty was sitting across the booth from them, looking disturbed in some way. And this came from a witness who was in the restaurant that night, who was a friend of all the families, knew everybody, and she stopped by the table, the booth, to say hi to Dwayne and Betty. And as she later told Betty's sister Jean, the way they were, Barbara and Dwayne were laughing together, just enjoying each other, and Betty was sitting across from them watching, the way this woman described it, it was as if Betty was suddenly realizing something that she had not known, i.e. that there might be a relationship between Dwayne and Barb. And, you know, this was in, and this witness, who was in her 90s by the time of the cold case, was interviewed in Texas. I mean, the cold case detectives really did as much as they could to you know, convict him and have the case go to trial. And one of the things they did was they sent somebody to Texas to interview this woman who had seen Barb and Dwayne and Betty the night before the murder. And she had a clear memory of it. And she, you know, it was in the 1973 police report, but nobody had followed up on it then. But they followed up on it in 2005 and found her to be credible. So Dwayne's confession was that the argument, or whatever it was, had started the night before the murder. In other words, Betty had launched into a crying jag that Friday night, evidently after the you know, the dinner at the Mexican restaurant, and then it had started up again the following morning, and he couldn't take it, and he started hitting her and couldn't stop. But there's also evidence that it was a little more premeditated than that. And that's something that Sendell, the lead cop in 73, filled me in on in 2013 or so when I interviewed him, because I had brought all the crime scene photos. And his theory was that Dwayne had lured Betty into the garage where she was bludgeoned to death. And one of the crime scene photos shows a stepladder next to the door, the entrance door between the door that connected the garage to the house, and her body was sprawled right in front of the door on the garage side. And the door is partly open, and right next to the door is a stepladder that's open. The direction of the blows on Betty's head, most of them were blows to the head. They never found the murder weapon, but Sendel was pretty sure it was a golf club because one was apparently missing from Dwayne's golf bag. And it was, that would have fit the wounds. And it looked like somebody hit her from above. And the way the ladder is set, it's exactly the vantage point that a killer would have used to strike her, in the back of the head with, a golf club. And one of the things that the cold case detectives did in 2005 is they did a reenactment in an attempt to identify what the murder weapon would have been. And interestingly, that some of the blood spatter was still, they could trace where the blood spatter had been, and they went to the house. It had not been remodeled. They did mock-ups of dummies with, hair and all that, to try to figure out, what she'd been hit with. And I think they used three different kinds of weapons, and a golf club best matched the spatter in the wounds. So, Sendel's theory was that Dwayne called her into the garage, summoned her, and he was waiting behind the door on the ladder, and he beat her. So in that sense, I think there was an element of premeditation. I mean, I think he decided that he had had enough, I don't think there was like a push and a shove that escalated. I think he decided he'd had enough. And, he acted on it.
Mm-hmm.
They never found his clothes, the clothes that he was wearing during, when she was murdered. And they had a description of the clothes because somebody else had seen him earlier that day. And the clothes he was wearing when he arrived at the karate studio, nobody would have worn, in 80 degree weather, So he was obviously wearing something else, So I think there was a level of premeditation.
Absolutely. Absolutely, by definition. I want to thank you so much, Stephanie, for coming on and talking about your book, Cold Case Story. It's been absolutely fascinating. For people that might want to take a look at this work, do you have a website, and is there an Amazon page for this book as well?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
My website is Writer Kane. That's W-R-I-T-E-R, Kane with a K, K-A-N-E.com. I've got an Amazon author page under Stephanie Kane, again with a K. And I'm on Facebook at author Stephanie Kane. And I love to hear from people. I always respond to emails. And, so I like the contact.
Yes. Thank you so much, Stephanie Kane, for Cold Case Story. You have a great evening. Thank you so much, and good night.
Thank you. Bye.